Patyanu Suyatin Yagye Suyasasa Sutan Tattam Durvasasam Somam Matmesha Brahma Sambhavan. Translation. Anusuya, the wife of Atrimuni, gave birth to three very famous sons, Soma, Dattatreya, and Durvasa, who were partial representations of Lord Vishnu, Lord Shiva, and Lord Brahma. Soma was a partial representation of Lord Brahma, Dattatreya was a partial representation of Lord Vishnu, and Durvasa was a partial representation of Lord Shiva. Purport. In this verse, we find the words Atma Isha Brahma Sambhavan. Atma means the Supersoul or Vishnu. Isha means Lord Shiva, and Brahma means the four-headed Lord Brahma. The three sons born of Anasuya, Dattatreya, Durvasa, and Soma were born as partial representations of these three demigods. Atma is not in the category of the demigods or living entities because he is Vishnu. Therefore, he is described as Vibhinamsa Bhutanam. The Supersoul Vishnu is the seed-giving father of all living entities, including Brahma and Lord Shiva. Another meaning of the word Atma may be accepted in this way. The principle who is the super soul in Atma, one may say the soul of everyone, became manifested as Dattatreya because the word Angsha, part and parcel, is used here. In Bhagavad Gita, the individual souls are also described as parts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead or super soul. So why not accept that Dattatreya was one of those parts? Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma are also described here as parts. So why not accept all of them as ordinary individual souls? The answer is that the manifestations of Vishnu and those of the ordinary living beings are certainly all parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, and no one is equal to him. But among the parts and parcels, there are different categories. In the Varaha Purana, it is nicely explained that some of the parts are Svamsha and other parts are Vibhinamsa. The Vibhinamsa parts are called Jivas, and the Svamsha parts are in the Vishnu category. In the Jiva category, the Vibhinamsa parts and parcels, there are also gradations. That is explained in the Vishnu Purana, where it is clearly stated that the individual parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord are subject to being covered by the external energy called illusion or Maya. Such individual parts and parcels can travel to any part of the Lord's creation. They are called Sarvagata and are suffering the pangs of material existence. They are proportionately freed from the coverings of ignorance under material existence according to different levels of work and under different influences of the modes of material nature. For example, the sufferings of jivas situated in the mode of goodness are less than those of jivas situated in the mode of ignorance. Pure Krishna consciousness, however, is the birthright of all living entities because every living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. The consciousness of the Lord is also in the part and parcel. And according to the proportion to which the consciousness is cleared of material dirt, the living entities are differently situated. In the Vedanta Sutra, the living entities of different gradations are compared to candles or lamps with different candle power. For example, some electric bulbs have the power of 1,000 candles, some have the power of 500 candles, and some the power of 100 candles, some 50 candles, etc. But all electric bulbs have light. Light is present in every bulb, but the gradations of light are different. Similarly, there are gradations of Brahman. The Vishnu Svamsha expansions of the Supreme Lord in different Vishnu forms are like lamps. Lord Shiva is also like a lamp, and the supreme candle power, or the 100% light, is Krishna. The Vishnu Tattva has 94%, the Shiva Tattva has 84%, Lord Brahma has 78%, and the living entities are also like Brahma, but in the conditioned state their power is still more dim. There are gradations of Brahman, and no one can deny this fact. Therefore, the words Atmesha Brahma Sambhavan indicate that Dattatreya was directly part and parcel of Vishnu, whereas Durvasa and Soma were parts and parcels of Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. Om Aginati Nirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksura Nuritam Jaina Tasma Ishikurave Nama Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutare Svayam Rupa Tadamayam Dharati Svapatantikam. Generally, the theory of evolution is taught. It's taught in grade schools, in high schools, and in colleges and postgraduate studies. It's taught in higher levels, like in medical schools, not only in this country, but all over the world. So a sequel to what Prabhupada said will be coming soon. In other words, he postulated that his disciples should establish that the Darwinian model is an imperfect one. He said, he asked that his scientists destroy or at least call into serious question this. He said that it is only a theory, and because it is not scientifically provable, that it should be brought into question. It should be established as nothing more than one of a number of theories. Theory is something that is not proven. It's like an hypothesis that hasn't undergone rigid or rigorous scientific proof. So this is what he asked his scientifically oriented disciples, those who had some experience and letters in science, to do. I was reading recently how he was giving some talks. Sometimes they were right here in Potomac. He would talk and they'd have meetings, what the goals and the strategy would be to show that this theory wasn't rigorously provable. And one thing was a maxim, or maybe it was some kind of a proverb. It might have been taken from Bengali language or something like that. But anyway, the idea was to use scientific thinking to dismantle an improperly constructed theory. So the sample was, the gross example, as he called it, was that of the axe handle and the tree and the blade, as if they could all talk. So the blade would say to the tree that I can't do anything, but I can't do anything to hurt you on my own, but I'll use part of you to cut you down. In other words, the blade would have to have a handle, and that handle would be made from the tree, and the axe blade with the handle from the tree would be able to cut the tree down. So that was one of the examples Prabhupada gave to his scientists, that we'll use the scientific method to show that this theory is not rigorously provable, to cut it down, in other words, to use its own methods of logic and reasoning to show that it's not acceptable, not rigorously provable. So this, the second part, or the sequel to this idea of not evolving from lower species to higher species, is to show that life began, so to speak, from higher species. It didn't rise up from lower, chaotic soup or bangs or inchoate masses swirling in space, but it came from Lord Brahma and progenitors of the universe who created the different types of living entities. This will be the second part of the equation, or the picture, how we came to exist, that all living beings were created from higher and simultaneously. So this is ordinarily considered to be a religious fantasy, that God said there was, let there be light, and there was light, or God said there was, how did that quote go? Something like that. Let there be light, and there was light. Let there be existence, and there was existence. So this is thought to be, in our very secular world, a sentimental belief system that has created a sense of opposition to this theory. Anyway, it's a big debate, but this country, which is leading the way in this debate, has influenced the whole world through its reach, through its TV and its internet and so on. And now it's being taught even in India, in its medical schools. Evolution is, it's referred to in medical books as the wonder of evolution. And all over the world, we'll see these books, they're used. Through the wonder of evolution, this happened. Through the wonder of evolution, that happened. So even though it's not proven, it's so widely accepted that almost everyone who's a doctor, for example, or been through medical school, or a medical researcher, believes that this theory is true, and it is the basis, and that anyone who doesn't believe it is some kind of a religious fanatic. That's the way it's been polarized. Of course, that maybe that's changing, but that's generally the way people look at it. So the sequel to forbidden archaeology and the hidden history of the human race will be something like that. Maybe it's called One Step Below the Angel or some working title like that. But the idea will be to give the conclusion so that the exposing of the theory of evolution is part one. To call into question the fact that it's not really provable, that it's never been proven, and that there are many gaps in it. There are many books actually now written on this subject, not even by our own people. And the second part will be the Siddhanta. Well, what if it's not true, what is true? Where did human beings come from? And how do all these other species happen to exist? So that's the second part. And it's also explained in the Bhagavad Gita that the Lord in the beginning sent forth generations of men and demigods. So there are many different ways in which it is said that creation took place according to the will of the Lord. Now we also know from what we were reading in the philosophy of Sankhya that in every phase of existence things proceed from subtle to gross. We have the example of a common example in our own world. A thing is conceived and then it is in detail, it is conceived, or maybe not in detail, it's conceived, and then in more detail that conception is filled out, and then the thing actually takes place in all of its detail. I was just looking at this house next door, and you can see how they're putting in the electrical fixtures and fittings, getting all the wiring in, and then framing it, and then they're going to put something over the frames and the rooms. So it's clear that somebody figured this out ahead of time. It's just not that the workers go in there and start doing whatever they feel like doing. They're working off of a blueprint. And that blueprint was very carefully conceived and worked out by one person sort of had the whole idea in mind that this is going to be there and that's going to be there, and designed it. And then the engineers maybe came in, or he used some engineering expertise to figure out how much weight should be, how much wood would require to bear the weight in the lower part of the frames and so on. So every detail is actually preconceived. And then when the builders get out there, they're completely working off the blueprint. They're not making up anything of their own. They're just working off that. If it says that the board is 5 inches thick, they have to get a 5-inch thick board, and so on and so forth. So everything proceeds from subtle to gross. Whatever we conceive of doing, it's conceived, and then it takes place. Sometimes we're making the video production, and if we have a very good script, then we can just go by that script if it's really well done, and the whole production comes out of that script. So from the mind of the personality of Godhead is the ultimate. There's nothing in the... we were reading in the second text of the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that now I will teach you everything, both phenomenal and numinous, everything that is known, everything that is to be known, and from this you will need to know nothing further. So that indicates that there is nothing that is actually new. Sometimes we talk about inventions or theories or inspiration or creativity, but all those things are actually not new, even though they appear new. Some new kind of car, it looks like, oh, that's the newest model, or some new development in our computers, it looks like it's new, or some new kind of paint that's graffiti proof or something like that. But whatever it is, it's actually all within the mind of the personality of Godhead. It's all there. And somehow the living entity is given some form of empowerment to tap into it and reveal it. Even people who do design work, they say that they copy other people or other designs. They don't actually invent anything new. And so even the people who get inspiration, they call it inspiration. What is inspiration? Sometimes people in a dream, they have an idea, and they see, like an inventor. And Prabhupada once used that quote that lazy intelligence is the highest form of intelligence. I think this is originally postulated by a German general, that first is lazy intelligence, then active intelligence, then lazy foolishness, then active foolishness. These are our four levels of intelligence. The active foolishness being like the monkey, who just constantly gets into trouble. But lazy intelligence is, he gave one example of a minister and a king. And the minister was very confidential to the king, and of course he enjoyed all the various opulences and salary and residences and so on. But one of the subjects in the kingdom was envious. Why is, you know, he doesn't seem to be doing anything very much. He's just kind of hanging around, and we're working very hard. Like me, he was a worker. So he said, why is it that he has such high position, gets so much opulence, the high salary, and so on? So the king understood that this man was a little envious. So he brought the two of them together one time, and he said, I want you to the so-called common subject. He said, I want you to weigh this elephant over here. And so I said, all right. And then he came back after some time. He was trying and trying. He said, I can't weigh him. So why not? There's no scale big enough to weigh anything this big. It's impossible. It can't be done. So then he said to his minister, I want you to see if you can weigh this elephant. Tell me how much it weighs. So the minister thought, and then he took the elephant down to the river and got him into some kind of a big boat. And what he did was he marked the water line on the boat before the elephant got in. And then when the elephant got in, he again marked the water line that the boat had sunk down to. So there was the water line without the elephant, which was lower down in the boat. And then after the elephant got in, he marked the water line, which was higher up in the boat. Then the elephant got out. And then he proceeded to fill the boat with weights, the empty boat with weights, until it sunk down to the level of the upper water mark where the elephant had been in. And thus he was able to weigh, even though he didn't have a scale. He knew how much each of the rocks weighed. He could weigh them individually, one at a time, and he added them all up, and he put them in, and then that was the weight of the elephant. So then he brought both the vassal, or the worker, and the minister back, and said that, see now, that's why. Because he used his lazy intelligence and he figured out how to do it. That's why he's getting more. So this is a form of he was just able to think. He was able to consider that even though there was no scale in the kingdom big enough to weigh the elephant, there were scales that were big enough to weigh rocks, and those rocks could be used to put in the boat to get the total amount of weight. So this is an example of a subtle kind of intelligence, a subtle proceeding from to gross. So in everything that we see, life works like that. Only children think that things take place automatically, or people with very little intelligence. They see an airplane, they just think it's flying. They don't realize how much energy, how many hours, how many people, how much technology was involved to make that airplane. So creation of the whole existence is also like that. It's all wound up within the mind of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And everything we see in nature, all of the branches and the trees, the ability of the birds to fly and the fish to swim, and the vultures to be able to see at a distance of many miles. This is called the Chintya Shakti, or inconceivable power. This is all from the Supreme Lord. So when it is said, Mamai Vamso Jiva Loke, the Amsas, or the part and parcels of Krishna, are partial expansions, they're expanding on some part of the inconceivable nature of Krishna, which is ultimately achincha. Nobody can actually understand how everything that there is to know, phenomenal and numinous, internal and external, can be within the mind of one person. That's the inconceivable power of the Lord. So whatever we see in nature that appears to be inconceivable, that's actually coming from the Supreme Lord. And that not only the inconceivable things, but the things that are powerful that we do not know, how they can work, how a panther can run so fast, or how a bird can fly in the air. It's said that those things are achintya shakti for a human being. A human being can't fly unaided, or stay in the water unaided, like for a long time, or see a great distance. So these things for a human being are achintya shakti, but for the Supreme Lord, who is all shakti, all combined, there's nothing that is not possible. So Prabhupada's making a distinction here between the Bibinamsa and the Svamsha living entities, that some are empowered more than others, but that everyone has the power, as he said, to become fully Krishna conscious, that every living entity has that power. Therefore it's said that when one becomes pure in consciousness, then one also at the same time attains all powers, all the siddhis, all the mystic siddhis that are mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion in different places. But a devotee doesn't want to utilize these powers. Whereas someone who's not actually engaged in devotional service might want to use these powers for ulterior purposes. So the special potency or empowerment given by the Lord can also, even though it is an advantage, it can also be misused. And therefore, it is sometimes said that spiritual life is like a razor's edge. One can become more powerful, and as we were hearing yesterday in Nudama's class, one can become very rich or very beautiful, and that can be a liability rather than an asset, even though it is originally given as a form of an asset. Sometimes when we visit people, they say, why does India have such bad karma? Because there's no wealth there, and there's so many disasters, so many natural disasters. But Prabhupada also said many times that it's a very great benediction to be born in India. It's a high birth. And then sometimes he said it was a high birth to be born in America because it's a wealthy country. High birth in India because there's spiritual consciousness pervading everywhere. And there's deities and temples and rituals that people practice of Krishna consciousness or Vaishnavism. And in America, sometimes he said it was a high birth even though there's no Krishna consciousness, because there's the advantage of wealth and facility. And when you may know this, when Prabhupada recorded the Krishna consciousness record, the first one called Krishna consciousness, at least one devotee told me this, I didn't see it, but after the record was made, Prabhupada offered his obeisances and kissed the floor and in a gesture that this was the country in which he could have facility for Krishna consciousness to reach out to millions of people through this recording. So sometimes he said it was advantageous, and sometimes he said it was disadvantageous. So depending on our good fortune, our ability to come into contact with a spiritual master and the Krishna consciousness movement, our birth can be auspicious or it can be inauspicious. And ultimately it depends on our good fortune, on our ability to see, to come into contact with a pure person or a pure movement or pure teachings so that we can get out of this material world. So whether one is Vamsa or Bibinamsa, in this very powerful position or just an ordinary position, the potential to become fully Krishna conscious is there, and it all depends on our ability to know how to recognize pure devotional service. And when the opportunity is there, to know how to seize that opportunity and make the best out of it, because it is a very rare, indeed extremely rare opportunity that one comes into contact with a pure devotee in this lifetime. And that surpasses all of the great benedictions that one can get, even as being Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma. And as it is stated that Lord Brahma can get up to 78%. So the living entity, the Jiva, the Jivatma, can get up to that percent of the qualities of Krishna that is said. We can't get into the Shiva tattva category or the Vishnu tattva category, but can have that much of Krishna's Shakti. And a devotee doesn't use that Shakti for ulterior motives, but uses it to advance the cause of Krishna consciousness and to further purify himself. So I'll stop there. We have English class this morning, that's why some of our devotees are there. Any Priya? Example Prabhupada gave of how it's dangerous is the idea of sacrificing animals based on the idea of testing mantras to see if they're pure. And if they're not chanted properly, the whole thing becomes spoiled and one can become an animal or one can have to be born as an animal many times. It just a slight error in performing a mystical feat can bring a reverse effect. And that happened in the case of Vitrasura in the yajna. There was a creation of an enemy instead of a friend. So it's very dangerous actually to practice mystical power. And when one actually attains some mystical power as a devotee, and through devotional service, one's not eager to exercise such things. I think there was a story about, Prabhupada was asked once to show a miracle. Not just once, but more than one time. And this was on a train in India. And because many so-called godmen, they do this. They actually have mystic power. And they can produce some gold or some ash or, something like that. They have mystic powers. So someone asked Prabhupada when he was with the group of disciples, can you just show some mystical power, something he can do? And he pointed to his Western disciples and said, "This is my miracle. I've created devotees out of them. made saints out of beasts, so to speak. What greater miracle could there be than that?" Anyway, these are very limited also, what you can do. Prabhupada used to criticize the people who... There was one person in India who could make a little nugget of gold appear in the hand. And Prabhupada said, "So what's the benefit of that? If he can produce... what's the benefit of producing one nugget of gold, a few carats of gold? If he's really powerful, let him produce a whole gold mine, then everybody can be rich. But what's the use of making just one pebble of gold? It's just some cheap thing." So for profit, adulation and distinction, people who have a little power misuse it, and they bewilder people. They think, "Oh, this is great." Like there's one that has an ash coming down, and ash appears in people's houses. And just on the basis of that, people think, "This is God. He's God." They're convinced that this person is God, or beyond reproach, because of mystic power. So mystic power is also sometimes very deceptive. And Durvasa, even though he's, as we read here, incarnation of a partial expansion of Lord Shiva, because he's so powerful as a yogi, it is sometimes said that yogis, they because of their pride, they lose their intelligence. And so in this way he caused trouble to Maharaj Ambarish and had to be chased by the Vishnu Chakra, or the Sudarshan Chakra, all over the universe. And so in different ways, he becomes proud and has to be chastised because of his power. So this kind of mystic power is often a corruptive influence and causes us to... just like in this Western world, get in a car. I notice even around here sometimes, devotees will get in a car and they'll drive around on this property, really fast. It's like scary, But it's just a natural thing that happens. You get in a car and just by making a very slight effort of pushing your foot down, you can move this huge machine, hundreds of pounds, at 80, 90 miles an hour. And it creates a feeling of power. You just push a button and, some great immense, the airplane flies, car goes. So we can understand how to be powerful, rich, famous. Quite amazing. I thought they'd all be angry and say that it's all those horrible white people that did this to us, or these horrible materialist capitalists that did this to us, or whatever. But that wasn't their mood. They were, in a way, more peaceful than someone who has to go into the office at 5 in the morning and start writing memos to himself and makes $200,000 or $300,000 a year and, gets ulcers and headaches and dies at age 45 or something like that. So it's depending on our level of empowerment, I'd say, it's how we use it that determines what is our ultimate worth as a human being. What am I worth? It's how it really gets back to, it's about how good of a devotee am I. That's how we are going to be judged, and how we should, if we're going to judge, we shouldn't judge, but really we kind of judge each other, or we size each other up indirectly or directly or openly or privately. And it's all always generally based on how deeply we've imbibed the devotional process, how well we've used whatever facilities we've been given by Krishna to engage in devotional service. So I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Śrīmad Bhāgavatam ki jai. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai. All glory to the assembled devotees.
Hare Krishna.
Om Ajanati Mirandasya Gananam Jana Salakaya Chaksurin Vitam Jaina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitana Manuvistam Stapidam Jaina Bhutade Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Shaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devam Kodavani Pracharane Nirvisesa Sunyavari Prasvatya Deshacharane Hare Krishna.
Hare.
So as we heard, Vrinda Devi or Tulasi Devi is very dear to Krishna, very sacred, and one of the most sacred places in the universe is the place where Vrinda Devi or Tulsi proliferates, and that is known as Vrindavan. Vrinda and Van means forest, the forest of Vrindas or Tulsis. This is where Krishna walked on the face of the earth 5,000 years ago and enacted his glorious pastimes. So many people aspire to go to Vrindavan and to spend their last days on this earth in that holy place where Krishna walked among the Tulsis, and which is sanctified and has been sanctified for the 5,000 years since Krishna's departure from this earth by many hundreds of great sages and saints and rishis and munis and other devotees of Krishna, even the ordinary people who live there daily. They circumambulate around the temples, around Vrindavan, around the Rajabhumi area, around Govardhan Hill. This is Vrindavan consciousness, the consciousness of the forest of Vrindavan, where Krishna was known by his thousands and thousands of friends, intimate friends, the gopis, by his foster mother and father, Yasoda and Nanda. So Vrindavan is not an ordinary place. It's not actually part of this material world. It's not part of India. Although geographically it's situated in one place. But the sanctity of this place makes it something otherworldly, not of this world. The place where many people go to die, to get out of this mortal coil, out of this, to leave their material body, to go back, hopefully, to the spiritual world where Krishna eternally resides. So those who make pilgrimage visits to Vrindavan, do so with the idea to develop Vrindavan consciousness or Krishna consciousness. Now that's the purpose of going there, not to simply let these places of pilgrimage become toxic waste dumps for our sinful activity, but to become eternally purified, to develop a permanent Krishna consciousness. Whether one goes there for 2 hours, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 years, or 20 years, or 40 years, the purpose of going there is to develop permanent Krishna consciousness. And this consciousness of Krishna can be taken away from Vrindavan, not just as a memory,
or a photograph, nor a video tape, but as a permanent change in consciousness, or more accurately, as a revival of our original consciousness. Because we are all Vrindavan conscious. We're all Krishna conscious by nature. But in this material environment, we have lapsed in our Krishna consciousness, or we've forgotten our Krishna consciousness. We've fallen asleep to our real consciousness, just like when we sleep at night. When we sleep at night, we forget our awakened state. And sometimes we have the experience when we wake up in the morning, it takes time for us to shake off the dream state or the drowsy state. Because in the dream state, we have forgotten what reality actually is. And we have a false sense of reality when we dream. So this material world is just like a dream in that sense. It is a forgetful state. We forget our real higher consciousness. So when we hear the holy name of Krishna, Vrinda, Radharani, we start to wake up a little bit and get a little flickering remembrance of our original constitutional, natural, normal, happy, healthy condition, Satchitananda. That is the natural condition of the soul, or Sanatana, or Bhagavad Dharma. That is the nature and the essential nature of the human existence. Not to toil and then die, but to awaken to our original position, to our original happy state. That is the meaning of human life. That is called Sanatana or Bhagavad Dharma. This state is also done through seva or service to Radha Krishna or Tulsi and Krishna. So by service to Krishna, wherever it may be, this Vrindavan consciousness is awakened and actually established within the heart. So Srila Prabhupada came from Vrindavan. He spent 6 years there, from 1959 to 1965, in the Radha Damodar temple in Seva Kunja. Seva Kunja is considered the center, most central, important part of all of Vrindavan and Vrajabhumi. And he meditated constantly and prayed constantly how to get the mercy from his predecessor, acharyas, like Rupa Goswami. And this temple, Radha Damodar temple, it's one of the places near where the Jamuna now flows. The Jamuna only runs through a very small part of Vrindavan. It is, since all the dams have been built, the course of the Jamuna has been diverted. It used to encircle the entire Vrindavan area. But due to the dams and pollution, the course of the river has changed. Nonetheless, this is a very sacred place. It contains 108 samadhis of great souls. So Srila Prabhupada began his translation of Srimad Bhagavatam in this place and constantly prayed for the mercy of Rupa Goswami and the other acharyas in his line of succession to give him the strength and the power and the mercy how to carry out the order of his Guru Maharaj, which was to not only translate Srimad Bhagavatam, but especially to translate many teachings of the Vedic literatures and to influence the English-speaking world in Krishna consciousness. So his idea was to bring Vrindavan consciousness to the West, to the Western world, through the medium of the English language. So he prayed constantly every day. He circumambulated this temple every day. He visited the other sacred temples of Krishna every day, offered his obeisances there, offered his respects, prayed for Lord Krishna's mercy. And little by little, by and by, his translations were completed. He made a few trips to Delhi to see that they were actually published. He personally worked with the printers, proofread the manuscripts. And his dream, which was actually the order of his Guru Maharaj, to bring Vrindavan to the West, began to be fulfilled when he sailed to the West, to specifically to America, to New York in 1965. And penniless, with no friends, he began. And what you see here today is one manifestation of the success of one who followed strictly the orders of his spiritual master, not just to preserve Krishna consciousness in India, or even to preserve it in the West, but to bring Vrindavan consciousness to the West, to actually transform. The reason he was given this order was due to the compassionate nature of the Vaishnav. A Vaishnav, a follower of Vishnu, is not, his main interest is not to preserve Vedic culture, although that is certainly a core interest. But the nature of a Vaishnav is to feel others' sufferings as one's own. And never before in recent history has the suffering of humanity reached current levels due to the influence of the age of Kali. Humanity is suffering more than ever before. With the advancement of technology, there has been more poisoning and more suffering mentally, in society, in the commodities we consume, and overall the earth is being slowly destroyed, and people are suffering from this as well. So this condition was foreseen by the great sages like Vyasadeva and others, who wrote their works with this idea of bringing some relief to the people of the age of Kali, who they could see would suffer. Therefore it is called the Iron Age, the age of Kali. So to develop a sense of Vrindavan consciousness is immediately to attain relief from material suffering. That's one of the first effects, to just hear of the glorious pastimes of Krishna, just like we were hearing some of Krishna's pastimes a few moments ago, his relationship with Vrindadevi, with Tulsi. Just to hear these things, Krishna has unlimited pastimes. There's immediately a sense of relief, because Krishna is enjoying. We like to hear about happiness and enjoyment. Unfortunately, due to the influence of the age, we're hearing about temporary and unsatisfactory, incomplete enjoyment. But when we hear about the unlimited enjoyment of Krishna in the spiritual world, which can fill not only the Srimad Bhagavatam, but can fill rooms and rooms of books, with books, cities full of buildings, full of rooms of such books, which never repeat themselves. This is the nature of spirit. It is infinite and ever-increasing. And that's what the human soul, that's what all souls are seeking for, is eternal happiness, unlimited variety. Krishna's pastimes are unlimited not only in their time and in their depth, but in their variety. Krishna enjoys not with just Tulsi or Radharani, but with thousands and thousands, actually billions of intimate associates. Constantly, Krishna is enjoying. And this enjoyment is delineated in great detail in the writings about Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam and many other Puranas and other works. So this is the balm, the consolation, the hope and the happiness for the condition. To hear, to get peace, to always remember Krishna, to live in Vrindavan consciousness, and to ultimately develop love for Krishna. This is the ultimate goal of a devotee of Krishna, to develop love for Krishna very deeply in the heart. And when this happens, this Vrindavan consciousness becomes like a great sun or moon which shines from the heart of the devotee. It purifies the whole atmosphere. And it spiritualizes anyone and everyone who comes into contact with such a devotee. So Prabhupada's mission, which was the mission of Vyasadeva and his predecessors, like his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, his spiritual master, Gaura Kishoredas Babaji, whose appearance was today, we're very fortunate, another great auspicious day today, our Srila Prabhupada's guru's guru, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was the father of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, Thakur Maharaj. They wanted, knowing the condition of the world, especially in the West, that this Krishna consciousness would be exported to the Western world and bring relief to a world which had no experience, at least not for many, many thousands of years, of Krishna or Vedic culture or any form of Krishna consciousness or Sanatana Dharma or any information about Vedic literature. This is what they wanted. In fact, in 1896, the year Srila Prabhupada was born, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur sent his books to America, actually to Canada, and they were placed in the library at McGill University. So it was a very auspicious day, or a year anyway. It was the same year Srila Prabhupada was born, and the first English books in the Gaudiya Madhva Sampradaya, Srila Prabhupada's succession, were implanted in the Western world. But it was not until Srila Bhakti Siddhanta gave Srila Prabhupada the mission to spread Krishna consciousness in the West that this mission was taken up with great earnestness and with an unflagging determination which would eventually prevail. And that determination, as I said before, was not simply to preserve a little corner or our little corners of Vedic culture and Krishna consciousness, but to influence major changes in consciousness in the Western world. Because if there is not influence to make major changes in the consciousness of the Western world, it will simply grind on and wear down the finer and spiritual sentiments that exist and create more and more factories, more and more anxiety, more and more pollution, and make life increasingly miserable for the conditioned soul. So Vrindavan consciousness is meant to burn like a great flame or show like a great beacon to give light and hope and happiness, to change people's consciousness. So this is the legacy we have from Srila Prabhupada. This is what he has bequeathed from the whole disciplic succession, from Krishna, from Radharani, from Tulsi, from the wonderful inhabitants of Vrindavan. A consciousness that can actually counteract the corrosive influence of the age of Kali and bring us back to our original consciousness. Prabhupada was lecturing once on the last verse of the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Yogi namapi sarvesha madhyate nam paratmanam sharavan bhajate yomam samayukta tamamataha. And as you know, this deals with the mind, this sixth chapter, how to control the mind. And through the process of jnana, through the process of yoga, dhyana, and of course through bhakti, the mind is meant to be controlled so that one can practice meditation, one can practice yoga and bring the mind under control. But in the age of Kali, it is very difficult, very, very difficult to control the mind. And therefore, silent meditation is not recommended in this yuga. Not at all. It is recommended in such a yuga where people were very peaceful and life was very quiet. The lifespan was long. There were no factories. But in this age of Kali, one has a very special dispensation. This is also explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam. This age is the most difficult. It is full of faults. Kaler dosha nidhe rajan. There is one good quality in this age of quality, in this age of Kali. Kaler dosha nidhe rajan. Asti hieka mahan guna. There is one good quality only. Krishna, kirtana Krishna. That is chanting the holy name of Krishna. Kirtana deva Krishnasya. Mukta sangha param vrajat. This is the one good quality of the age of Kali, that one can chant the holy name of Krishna. So in this lecture, Prabhupada was speaking about the importance of this form of meditation, about chanting the holy name of the Lord. And he was explaining how difficult it is to quiet the mind in this age. So he said the secret of controlling the mind is to tax your brain how to spread this Krishna consciousness movement. The secret is to constantly think how Vrindavan consciousness, consciousness of Krishna and Tulsi, Krishna and Radharani, Krishna and Yashoda, Krishna and Nanda. Krishna is never alone. He's always with, as we see him here, he's with his eternal consorts, his eternal relatives, his eternal friends, his Purusha incarnations. We should always think how this awareness of Krishna can spread. And spreading this means how to transform consciousness. In 1969, Prabhupada received one letter from a gentleman who was visiting our London temple. Actually, he visited the temple quite by accident. He was a postman, and he used to ride a bicycle. And I was there the day he came. He didn't seem very happy living in London. He was about 60 years old. His name was Lakshmidas Bhattaresha. I think he wished that he hadn't come to England. But nevertheless, he was doing his postal service, and he was delivering the post, the mail to the temple this day. It was his first day. And he didn't know it was a temple. He saw the sign outside. So he came in, and I was very surprised. He immediately prostrated himself before the deity. And there were tears in his eyes. And he sat there for about half an hour and offered his dandavats again and again, and offered some prayers, and then he went away. But he came back every day after that. And we used to talk sometimes. And I didn't know he had written a letter to Prabhupada, but Prabhupada apparently got this letter, and he wrote to the magazine of the Hare Krishna movement, Back to Godhead, said, "I want you to publish this letter." So then I didn't know about it until I saw it published in Back to Godhead magazine, because it said at the bottom of the letter, Lakshmidas Bhattaresha. What Prabhupada liked most in the letter was this phrase. He said, "You are performing, there are many miracle men in India. I've seen them. They actually can perform miracles. But your miracle is the greatest of all miracles, because I've seen it with my own eyes. You are transforming beastly humans into godly saints." So that's Srila Prabhupada's miracle. He's not doing any magic, but he's actually transforming people immersed in the darkest of the darkest of times, in the darkest of places, and giving them the highest gift. And he's giving it to them in such a way that it can proliferate. So when we talk of purity of the pure devotee, the measure of that purity is how much it will be self-generating, how many lives will actually be transformed. When lives transform, then the whole atmosphere transforms. When you walk into someone's house who's happy and healthy and living a pure, good life, the whole atmosphere of that house is very invigorating, very peaceful. So the more souls that are transformed, the whole environment changes. And even in the Kali Yuga, an atmosphere of peace and calm can prevail. Prabhupada said even if only 1% become Krishna conscious, the whole atmosphere of the world will change. So we have to try for that, and in the course of doing it, if we only transform one or two, or even our own selves, there is no loss, nothing to lose. So we should think every day to do what exactly Prabhupada said and his guru said, how to spread Krishna consciousness. And that means how I can make a deeper commitment to my own spiritual life first, because if I'm not advancing, I can't help others. And then how to help. And Prabhupada has given us a very wonderful system, quite systematic. It's working all over the world. And all we have to do is get on board. The train is already moving. And we can benefit ourselves and we can do the best service to others. So that's Vrindavan consciousness. Vrindavan is actually unlimited. It's explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam that Vrindavan is actually a form of Krishna, and it expands and contracts according to Krishna's needs and desires. This happened. When Krishna performed some pastime with many devotees, Vrindavan actually expanded. When he was performing a small rasa dance with a few gopis, it contracted. And for many other reasons, this Rajadham, Rajabhumi, expanded and contracted. So just as Rajadham expands and contracts, so the whole of Vrindavan can expand all over the world. And it can expand all over the universe. Just like a ripple dropped in the water will create waves that ripple to the bank. So the waves of the Sankirtan movement, and Lord Chaitanya predicted this, would spread all over the world like a great inundation, and then they would ripple to the very walls of the universe. So we have the opportunity to participate in that movement. So please help us. We're only a small minority, but Prabhupada used to say that purity is the force. And that's what we should remember. So thank you very much.
Thank you.